This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one.
Till bookings, but smaller regions also reporting a surge in interest. Mention Niagara Falls. The mayor of Niagara Falls, Ontario, Jim Diodati, will be joining Libby later this hour. Now, events in Miramichi in New Brunswick will kick off 5 days before the event with a drone light show, musical performances, and astronomy conference. Zoomer Radio weather, mainly sunny for now, increasing cloudiness later, high 11, currently 7, 44 Fahrenheit. I'm Bob Komsic. News next at 1 on Zoomer Radio.
Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome and happy Easter. It's Monday, Easter Monday, time for our Zoomer Squad, and last week's provincial budget, in Ontario held a welcome surprise, something CARP has been calling for years, and that is a hefty $2 billion over 3 years for home care. But what the Ontario government giveth, the federal government may be taking away. The carbon tax kicks in today. Gas price increases are the first noticeable sign. It's $1.63 a liter in most places around here. And that cancels much of the 5.7 cent a liter break that the province extended in the budget. And there is also a very good news medical story, because a Markham man now holds the Guinness World Record for being the oldest man to receive a kidney transplant. Now, Walter Toro was 87 years old when he underwent the surgery last year. He's now 88. And I think this strikes a blow against ageism in medicine. What do you think? The numbers, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Rudy Boutignol, president of CARP, Anthony Quinn, chief community officer of CARP, and I believe we are waiting for a pollster. Is that right? Okay, I guess so. All right. So let us begin with this medical milestone. And here's what I'm talking about. Sometimes certain procedures are withheld from people of a certain age. And it recently became very real for me because I know two people who had colonoscopies who were told this is probably the last one. One of them being my husband, who is probably one of the fittest people on the planet for his age. He's got lots of longevity in his family. And they always find polyps. So when I asked our medical panel what would the reason for this be, they said, well, polyps take a long time to grow into cancer, and it has to do with the average life expectancy. I thought, that's pretty ageist. But here we have a guy, 88, and he was warned that he might not survive the operation because of his age, but here he is, and it's the following year, and he's doing well, and he got the transplant. So what do you think, Anthony?
I think he's a very lucky man to have lived such a long and healthy life, and then to benefit from the Ontario medical system. But transplants are interesting. They're a very finite resource, and with a kidney, they can last 15 to 20 years. So my thought is, if there is a finite resource and there's a 40-year-old person perhaps who is on the same list as he is, do we provide the kidney to the person who could use it the longer period of time or to the person who is just next on the list? That's the balance between transplants and those very finite resources.
Well, we give it to the person it matches is one of the main things. Rudy, what's your view of this?
Well, one has to be the right candidate at the right place at the right time. And so there are a lot of factors going into kidney transplants. I was involved in putting together a big series for television on transplants. And he seemed to be the right guy. He was following the program, doing what he was supposed to do. So he was at the right place at the right time. And I think good for him. And, you know, one hopes it didn't take it away from a young, much younger person. But, hey, he's got a lot of life left in him, too.
Well, exactly. And I remember years ago, a friend of mine, her mother, there was a big controversy about whether her mother would get a hip replacement at the age of 90. Well, her mother ended up living to the age of 101. So, you know, 10 years, I think that's pretty good, Anthony.
I think the discrimination in medical care is certainly a important factor, and CARP is aware of those complaints that we receive from our members. But a hip replacement isn't a finite resource. They're making them in the United States and bringing them to Canada, as many as we can buy. So the hip replacement, I think, is a consideration if the woman was living in pain and there was a procedure to help alleviate that pain, that should be certainly put on the list and get in line with everyone else waiting for hip replacements. But with the transplant, I think that's specific to that right place and right time. And if the average life expectancy in Canada is late 70s for men, he's already decade past that.
Yeah, well, I think but a lot of people live to 100. Centenarians are the largest growing part of the population. Go ahead, Rudy.
I think what was important, I mean, this is clearly such an unusual case that it makes the Guinness Book World of Records. But what it does is strike a blow for ageism in the sense that it says, look, the doctors have taken everything into consideration, including the finite resource, and this person was a good candidate. Let's look at the person, not the age. And, you know, it's good for him and good for the doctors going ahead and doing it.
The Ontario Human Rights Code says that we can't discriminate based on age in our healthcare system. So it's good news that the transplant teams and those who made the decisions did follow the code and not discriminate based on his age. But we know that in the medical system there is discrimination based on age, from the patient-doctor interaction where they might speak to them as a condition rather than an individual. They may speak to a caregiver who comes to the medical visit rather than directly to the patient. And we know that when patients are in the confines of a doctor's office, they're not likely to bring up other ailments that they may have to they want to talk to about the doctor, but they're afraid to. So that discrimination
was a point where you could only talk about one thing at one visit, and that it had nothing to do with age. I think that's gone now. It people have complex conditions, so I don't think it's a good way to take care of anyone. But that was a thing, and it got quite a lot of publicity. So I'm not sure that is age-related.
Training in medical school so that all the family doctors know how to deal with elderly patients respectfully and treat them as individuals, not as old age.
Well, yeah, and by the way, don't call them dear. That drives people really around the bend. I'm going to take a call from Jim in Brampton. Hi, Jim.
How are you doing today?
Fine. How are you?
Well, I'm good. I'm good, I'm just saying, I've been asked to sign the DNR twice, even though I'm only 75 years old, but I was asked to sign it twice in two different times in the merge, and I thought, what's going on here? He said, if you sign the DNR, you'll go quietly. And I said, no, I'm going to kick and scream. What's going on? I never asked for them to sign it. They asked me to sign it. I said, what's going on with this thing, you know? But, you know, they just did not want to deal with me tying up a bed.
Well, the DNR is do not resuscitate.
Do not resuscitate. I think most people know that. And, I mean, I guess it also depends on what the condition was. But I don't think I haven't heard about people being asked out of the blue to sign one unless they were really terminal. And you sound like you are alive and kicking, Jim.
Oh, and honestly, I up until last year, I played hockey. But 3 years ago, they tried to get me to sign the DNR because I know I had pneumonia. I know that. But I recovered from it. And then one other time, too, I was put in isolation because I got bit by something. And they said it was some kind of a spider. And I was going to develop skin disease. And they said, sign the DNR and you'll go quietly. I said, no, I'm not going to go quietly at all.
Okay, good for you, Jim. Thank you for telling us about that.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'd like to bring in John Wright. Hi, John, Vice President at Maru Public Opinion. So are there polls on this question of an age cutoff for certain medical procedures?
I'm sure there are. I don't know of any that I've done. But I know that there's been, of course, great debate federally and especially in the Senate on different aspects of, ending your life on your consent. But I haven't done anything specifically.
And what's your sense of it? I mean, people are aging, they're living longer and better. And this idea that certain medical procedures are, it's all a question of judgment of the doctor, right? But that are being rationed for older people with the rationale, well, they may not live long enough. What's your sense of that?
Well, as someone who may fall within that range at some point, I'm not really sure it's something that I would support. Look, I really don't believe that rationing the healthcare system is the way to go. But we do have some very serious problems, and just in terms of even having a family doctor. So there's a capacity issue that clearly is in the system, but trying to, impose or have even an understanding that's unwritten that this is going to, apply to people who are older as opposed to others, it's just something that would be outrageous to not just people who are older, but to society as
well. Well, remember in COVID, this will be the last thing I bring up with regards to this. But remember in COVID, there were protocols unwritten about who to triage, and some of it involved age, Anthony.
And they were instructed to leave the COVID-infected patients who were in long-term care homes in long-term care homes, which led to the spread.
Which led to the carnage and the disasters in long-term care.
And that was certainly based on age, but also life expectancy and the person's stage of life.
Yeah. So I think we're getting there on this, but it's still a struggle not to pigeonhole older people and not to decide that they're not worthy of certain procedures. Moving along to our pocketbooks. So today is the day that carbon tax kicks in. The first place we're seeing it is in gas prices. The government keeps saying that, don't worry, you'll get more back in the rebate. John, do people believe that?
I don't think they do. I think the policy itself is irrational at the moment, and I say that simply from the fact of looking at polling on the environment for these many years. I think the first poll I did on it was back in 1991 when we were discussing the blue boxes at that stage. The whole notion that you make certain things more expensive to change behavior in society is not new. What you're trying to do is have people adapt to circumstances where they're going to change their behavior to do good for society. If the idea is to make carbon more expensive and therefore those things that are produced by it or from it, then you are going to hopefully have people make behavioral changes. But the question is, to what? Because if you don't have a transit system, if you don't have the right vehicles that are available, if you don't have a cost structure and such that people can move towards those things, then it makes it really very, very difficult for that behavior to take place. The second thing is that it's hard to reconcile that if you are going to do it to change behavior, but you're going to give 80% back to people, then that's not necessarily going to change their behavior. So there are places in this country, I can think of a number of them down in the eastern part of the Maritimes, which in fact there are some towns who have gathered together to try and have more efficient energy for a whole bunch of people in their area, which has dropped the cost overall as a direct response to the carbon taxes. But
you know, as somebody who went to the gas station last night and found, you know, like 300 cars lined up down the street to save 3 cents on a liter, that's not really changing behavior at all, because there really isn't much of an alternative to change towards.
Well, yeah, and, you know, this whole business of the rebate, I'm thinking, you know, what's the admin cost for that? Rudy, are CARP members worried about that? I mean, affordability is a huge issue for everyone, especially people on fixed incomes. What is the CARP take on that?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, a carbon tax is great in principle. It's taxing carbon, which we want less of. Makes sense. But the way it's been gone through, speaking to what John said, that there's no alternatives for a lot of people. So I think what our members see is that the cost of living is going up, and here's one more tax on top of the other taxes and making things more expensive. So I think our members are concerned about climate change, and I'm sure they would respond really well to a comprehensive approach to it. And that is, if you tax the carbon to reduce, say, driving, then you have offsets like public transit and the like. Also, with this government, it's been great on announcement, but very poor on execution. And they politicized the issue themselves when they exempted the home heating fuel in the Atlantic provinces, but didn't do the same for the gas-fueled prairie provinces, for instance. So great in principle, terrible in execution, and just seems to add to the cost of living. And should I just add, I'm in Vancouver today, where the regular cost of a liter is over $2, around $2. So,
oh, okay. Well, that is something that might discourage some driving, Anthony.
Yeah, Quebec, BC, and the Northwest Territories, or perhaps Nunavut, one of the Northern Territories, have their own carbon pricing. So BC didn't get the bump today that we did in Ontario, because they have their own system. And it's been quite punitive in BC for a long time.
For a long time. I know that when I go visit, I'm a little, wow, it is eye-popping. On the other hand, we got a very positive surprise in the Ontario budget last week, because I remember us here a week ago saying, we don't think there's anything for Zoomers coming up in the budget, and lo and behold, $2 billion over 3 years, Anthony.
It's a tremendous response from the provincial government that has been asked by CARP and by a number of other groups interested in the care and of seniors in their own homes. So $2 billion over 3 years, on top of another billion that came out post-COVID when we saw the need for having people remain in their own homes. So that will go towards funding PSWs, transportation for seniors, assisted help in a home, and day programs. So that type of money was on the priority list for CARP in 2022. At the election time, we listed the CARP 5, and home care was our number one ask. So we're delighted that the province has responded.
Okay, well, of course, questions are, is that going to solve the labor shortage? Because, you know, there is, I guess, more money maybe to pay certain workers, like PSWs are already getting a little bit more, but most of them, I think, are still temp workers without benefits, and it's a tough job. It's a very important, tough job.
In the minister's presentation in at Queen's Park, he did say that it would go to increasing the training and retention and increasing the salaries. So yet to see how that will work out, but you can't sneeze at an extra $2 billion going into the system.
No, and it was interesting, you know, the response from the NDP opposition leader, the first response was, there's nothing in this budget for anyone, and I had quite a long talk with her on Thursday, on this show last Thursday, and she didn't quite say that. She was saying things like, well, it depends how it's spent, which obviously it does depend how it's spent.
No, one of my personal concerns about home care with my own parents is that the province is funding agencies who are taking a profit themselves before they send out those workers. So if the PSWs could become part of the healthcare system directly in the future, I think that would be a way to get the best for our tax dollars.
Well, I have to tell you, and I want to get to John Wright about the feelings about this in a moment, but I've had home care. Thank goodness, I didn't need it for very long. And Doug Ford came to power talking about abolishing these LINs. They are bureaucrats that actually ration the home care. So you're in the hospital calls the LIN and says you need this or that, and the LIN decides whether or not and how long and all of that. These people, it's a culture problem. I don't think it can be fixed. From my point of view, those public sector, that public sector institution is the biggest problem. The private health care, I mean, it's expensive, and they do, you know, the way it's set up, it costs a lot of money, and they do take quite the hefty cut. But they deal with the patient more than the LIN. The LIN, you're just a number, you're just a file. They are so far removed from patients, it's like it's dehumanizing. But that's my little speech on that.
Well, the LINs are gone, and now there's a...
No, they're not gone. The name was changed. No. The name was changed. The structures are the same. It's called home and community care, and they didn't even get rid of many of the hundreds and hundreds of people who work in this. But the people don't really want to deal with patients. Anyway, John Wright, in terms of polling, I mean, that's one of the things I think that crop up in your polls all the time, people wanting to age in place, to age at home.
Yeah, it also depends on how you define where you're going to age. I mean, we all want to age in a place that we call a dwelling. I'm not sure a long-term care bed is what I would call a dwelling, as defined now by the government. But yeah, of course, they want to stay there. The question for me, being a bit of a cynic nowadays about all of this sort of stuff, is that what we hear from government constantly is what they teach you when you're going to be making a speech, and that is tell them what you're going to tell them, tell them what you told them. Tell them what you're going to tell them, tell them what you told them, and sit down, without actually delivering anything. So the question in my mind is always, and I think for a large part of the population, you can say you're going to deliver $2 billion. You can stand up and actually state it clearly that you're going to deliver it and sit down. But the question is whether it's going to flow through, and what is the priority of that, and how are you going to resource it? So I guess, you know, whether you're doing polling on it or you're going to be on the receiving end, you're a bit skeptical that what the government promises nowadays is actually going to end up working. Let's remember, this is also the government that promised a whole set of developments for new homes, and they are so far off their targets, it's just not going to happen. So I'll believe it when it's actually working in the home care sector.
Right, and part of that money, of course, you have to re-elect them to get it. That's a thing that the Liberals keep doing too. It's always, you know, the devil is in the details, and I think that we're all getting a little bit skeptical about this stuff. But hey, $2 billion for home care for something people want.
It's what they want, and it also leads to savings down the healthcare train. If you can be cared for in your home, then you're not going to ER on a regular basis. You're not backing up the lineups in ER. You're not stuck in a bed waiting for additional institutional care and long-term care. It's the smart way to invest healthcare dollars in carpets, plaid.
And another part on my high horse is that I've been told for a LIN that rather than sending someone for 15 minutes for a problem, they go to Emerge, even though it'll cost way more in Emerge. So I'll get off that topic and take a call from Sheila in Mississauga. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, how are we doing? I know it is a little bit off the subject, but it's in regards to agencies. We are living in a world where we are not hired by companies. We have to go to agencies in regards to every aspect of work. And they are
what
the
is your work, Sheila?
Our resume, send it to the right candidate or the company. In my case, I had all the experience for 30 years in my field.
What is your field, Sheila?
I'm in a printing industry. I did lots of printing for you guys, too.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. It is a little bit off topic.
What happened, I lost my job. I was fired. I lost my job. I sent in a resume on Monday to the company agency. She called me right away for an interview. I went there. She seen me. She sent my resume, and right away the person replied saying, yeah, we are interested. Can you send her over? When I went there, she hired me, and she bought me off from the agency, paying the agency $24,000.
Okay, that's thanks, Sheila, for your call. That is a whole other discussion, usually about headhunting agencies. That sounds like it's probably a very senior job, and sometimes it's a whole year's salary in the hundreds of thousands that headhunting agencies get paid, right? But like I said, that's a whole other topic. So just to wrap this up before we go, again, is there a feeling, John, that the government is listening? Because again, this aging in place thing is something that people are really fixed on, though, of course, sometimes it's not possible given people's conditions at the end of life.
Again, I think if you ask people specifically whether or not governments are listening, most people will say they're not listening to the priorities that people need. I mean, that's just the way it is. I think on this case, the proof is in the pudding, isn't it? I mean, you can, if you've got a good response, and especially if you were lobbying for something, you've got something in the window that you can work towards, it's better than not having anything. But the real issue will be, where's the blueprint? What have we done other than announce it? Are we pulling together, you know, a cross-sectoral group of stakeholders? What is the plan moving forward as opposed to simply the announcement of the money? Now, it may be that that's below the surface that common folk don't see, but for people who are seniors, for people who are moving in that particular direction, they want more assurance than simply that somebody's going to pay for something at the end of the day.
And Rudy, does CARP have any plans to hold them to it?
Well, we lobbied the government. It was part of our position in the last provincial election. This is a huge win for CARP. But clearly, the government is listening, and they respond to the need of home care. That's what overwhelmingly almost everyone wants. As John said, the devil's in the details. It's about delivery. And we've seen with our federal government and other governments that it seems to be government by press release. It's like, great, what's the plan? How are you going to deliver? When are you going to deliver it? And how much is it going to cost? That seems to be where things are stuck. And that's where I think you spoke to a need for culture change. That needs to change so that we get these services to where they're needed. Home care, it's a win for CARP. It's a win for seniors. And right now, we're going to take that.
Anthony, last 20 seconds
and
to you.
We will be holding the government's feet to the fire on this file. Contacted the ministers responsible to making sure they're delivering.
Okay, thank you so much. Anthony Quinn, Rudy Boutignol, and John Wright. We will talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, we're taking a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some really big goodies for all kinds of people in the public sector while the rest of most everybody is really grappling with affordability. When we return,
you're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. While most of us are grappling with a much higher cost of living and stagnant wages, there are some big goodies for people in the public sector. Now, firstly, Prime Minister Trudeau is giving MPs an $8,500 raise with a base salary of $203,100. That's making them the second highest paid elected officials behind the U.S. And Canada's next mandatory general election date is or was October 20th, 2025, but the Trudeau government has revised it to 1 week later, October 27th. Now, they're saying it's because they don't want it to fall on Diwali, but shifting the date ensures that a number, a fair number of MPs who were first elected in 2019, many of whom are NDPers or Liberals projected to lose in the next election, well, they will just pass the six-year threshold required to qualify for a lifetime parliamentary pension that starts as early as the age of 55. Sounds pretty good. And then there's also the question of the Ontario Sunshine List. Is it past its best before date? We'll get into that as well. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Franco Terrazano, the Federal Director of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Hi, Franco.
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
You're very welcome. So let's start in Ottawa. What do you make of both these things, the raise for MPs amid this affordability crisis and that pension thing?
Oh, it's awful. What is going on? I mean, there's a lot to break down. So let me just start with the pay raise, okay? So on the very same day today that members of parliament reach deeper into our pockets, they're going to be stuffing more money into their own pockets, right? Because today, carbon tax is going up federally. You have alcohol taxes going up, and you have MPs giving themselves a raise. And as you mentioned, the pay raise will range from an extra $8,500 all the way up to an extra $17,000 for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. So here are the salaries now for our politicians in Ottawa. An MP, their salary will be $203,000. Making them the second highest paid elected officials in the world.
Yep.
A minister will be making just shy of $300,000. And Prime Minister's salary, Mr. Trudeau, his salary will be 406,000 smackers.
Okay. And free vacations. Let's not forget about those.
Paid for by the taxpayer.
And his good friends. So we have that. What about this move of the election date and the pensions that are involved? Because if the polls are right, the Liberals are really going to get hammered in the next election, and perhaps the NDP will too.
Well, I don't know. So here are the details, right? It takes them 6 years, members of parliament, to qualify for a pension. Well, the next scheduled election date is October 21. And or October 20th, sorry,
yeah.
But they're not eligible for the pension until the 21st. So bumping the election back a week would mean 80 additional MPs would qualify for that sweet, sweet taxpayer-funded pension, okay? And now the cost of pensions for those 80 MPs would be about $120 million. Now, I understand that not all 80 of those MPs will lose their seat. However, if even half of those MPs lose their seat, moving the election back 1 week would cost taxpayers tens of millions of dollars. And let me just illustrate how lucrative these pensions are for members of parliament. So you'll have some of these MPs who will work in office for just 6 years and still be eligible to collect a lifetime pension of more than $2 million, okay? 6 years as a member of parliament for some of these ladies and gentlemen, and they'll still be eligible to collect more than $2 million.
Let me give the numbers out again. I have a hunch that some people may have something to say about this. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And we're talking about these new measures to put more money in the pockets of our elected politicians and possibly pensions for life. And it's coming soon. And this is the day when the carbon tax is kicking in. Oh, and there is one good piece of news that we forgot to mention. Minimum wage is going up a teensy bit for people in federally regulated sectors. Let's talk to Peter in Toronto. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to make an issue on the carbon tax. They're raising the taxes, and it's not fair for the people who work in the private sector. Their wages are low, and gives the manufacturer an excuse to raise the prices. It's the people, the private sector, who are really hurting. They're getting a rebate, but it'll be, how long are they going to wait? But then again, it's not fair for the poor people.
Yeah, and what do you think about all these little goodies for these MPs?
Well, I don't think they don't show an example. It should show an example to all Canadians that we are also You know, they're not giving us a raise to show that we do, you know. It's not, I don't think it's right.
Okay. Thank you for that. Yeah, leading by example. That seems to be long gone on a lot of fronts, ministerial responsibility, whatever else. But yeah, these things. Now, on the other hand, here in Ontario, on the weekend, that sunshine list was released, and there are now 300,000 people who earn over $100,000 annually in Ontario. So, the question is, though, I mean, it was introduced a long time ago by the Harris government when $100,000 was really a lot of money. And certainly if you live in Toronto and you make $100,000, it's a good salary, but you aren't going to be rich like that. So, Franco, should the threshold be raised for reporting this or making an issue out of it, or should it be gone? What's your thought on that?
Well, you absolutely have to keep the sunshine list. Absolutely have to keep the sunshine list in Ontario. And you know what? Kudos to the Ontario government that it actually has a very detailed sunshine list. And this is very important. I mean, it's a matter of two things. Number one is just government transparency, right? Canadians, we're the boss. We pay the taxes around here. We should know who the six-figure salary earners are in government. But number two, it's also about government accountability, right? Because now, because of the sunshine list, we know that there's what? More than 300,000 government employees in Ontario making a six-figure salary, an increase of more than $30,000 from the year before. So that's good to know. That is good to know for the public, especially at a time when you have the Ford government posting these massive deficits, right? Canadians and Ontarians need to know to be able to hold their government accountable so they can be like, well, hold on a second. No wonder you're running this massive deficit if you're not willing to rein in the size and the cost of the ballooning bureaucracy.
But should that $100,000 threshold, should that be raised? Because as I said, 100K isn't what it used to be.
Yeah, I think that's a conversation that can happen. And I think people can debate over that. I mean, $100,000 is still a lot, right? And at the end of the day, the boss deserves to know exactly how much his people are making. So we're not saying like everyone who's working in government needs to be on the sunshine list. That's not what we're saying. But I think $100,000 is still reasonable.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Oh, I will take one very quick call from Jim in Pickering. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon, Libby. Libby, I'm wondering where they get the information from that sunshine list and how they determine it. Because don't forget, some people work extra hours or two jobs, and they have investments, and they've invested well, and they make it there. So
no, that's salary that they're talking about.
Is it? And how did they determine that? Through CRA? Or where did they get this information?
Well, they're the ones that pay. They pay.
Yeah, I realize that.
So, yeah, thanks for your call. I'm going to wrap things up now. Franco Terrazano, thank you so much for that.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
We're taking another break, and when we come back, I have to say I was a little flummoxed on the weekend when I heard that Niagara Falls has declared a state of emergency because of the eclipse a week today. Well, what do you think of that? We are going to drill down into that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the much-hyped, once-in-a-lifetime total solar eclipse is set to arrive 1 week today. Now, officials in Niagara Falls believe as many as a million people will descend on the city for that event. Now, I question that number, but leaving that aside, it's going to be a lot of people. Now, the region has declared a state of emergency. Seriously. Is that the best solution? The numbers to call, what do you think? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Jim Diodati, Mayor of Niagara Falls, Ontario, and Natalie Preddy, travel expert and travel freelance writer. Hello, both of you, and thanks for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Jim Diodati. So first of all, this state of emergency was declared by the region. What's your reaction? Do you think it's the right thing to do?
Well, there's two schools of thought. I mean, I wasn't told of it in advance. Unfortunately, it was the end of the day, Thursday before a long weekend. So I didn't have a lot of time to really digest it or get questions answered. But I do understand, out of an abundance of caution, they want to make sure that everybody's fully prepared. It does give us another chance to remind people to come prepared, you know, gas tanks filled and medication and comfortable shoes and all the things they need to do. And also, apparently, it allows the regional government to access provincial and federal funds for the extra police and ambulance and fire staff and whatnot that'll be deployed for that big event.
I mean, honestly, when I first saw it a week in advance, I mean, I thought it was, I mean, I giggled a little bit. Was I, you know, was I wrong to do that, Mayor Diodati?
Well, no, we were all a little surprised. It kind of came out of left field. And usually, you know, declarations of emergency are saved for real emergencies like tornadoes and earthquakes and things like that. I understand the concern because I'm sure as the roads get jammed up, ways and the GPS will direct people onto back streets and side roads, and it's going to impact the entire region. The entire region is in the path of totality. So regardless, there's going to be a massive crowds here, and they're going to be coming from all different directions, even along the U.S. border. They've got signs they put up a while ago warning people of extended delays and be patient and come prepared and bring your glasses, things like that. So, you know, it's a good question. I mean, obviously, we'll have lots of Monday morning quarterbacks, or in this case, Tuesday morning quarterbacks, who will, you know, dissect what happened. And but it, again, regardless, it'll be the biggest event in the city's history.
Natalie Preddy, what's your reaction to this state of emergency?
Well, again, I, you know, as the mayor said, I usually think of them, you know, more for natural disasters or things like that. So, I mean, I don't know enough about Niagara Falls tourism specifically and the region and whether or not it will be an emergency. But, you know, I guess we'll wait and see.
But, I mean... Honestly, the first thing I thought of when I heard about it, and I was here for this and I covered it, was Mayor Mel Lastman calling in the military for a big snowstorm. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. But the one thing that the effect that it might have would be to convince a lot of people not to go to Niagara Falls. And that might be a desirable thing, Jim Diodati.
So that's a good point. And there's two sides to it. So on one end, it's given a whole bunch of extra media coverage, including in the U.S. along their major media channels. So that's on one end. It's actually drawing more attention, almost like a moth to the flame. But on the other side, I can tell you, I did receive a contact from the Hotel Motel Association that there are still rooms available, that there have been some last minute cancellations because of the emergency announcement. So I guess it's a good news, bad news thing. Now for people looking for rooms, there's actually reasonably placed rooms that are available in the city for the weekend, because it will be a long weekend because there will be no school on the Monday, and a good chance for some families to get away after the winter.
So wait a minute. So people who booked like a hugely expensive room, they can cancel it and get a reasonably priced room?
Well, people who canceled I guess that would be the case if that was what was happening. But some people did book a year out. Some people booked six months out before the rates started to elevate. So there is some opportunities there. It's a real fluid market.
Well, the other thing I heard is that, you know, there's a lot of personal entrepreneurship, people renting out their driveways or their backyards. What happens in a case like that if somebody can't get to the spot that they paid money for, and it's, you know, whether it's an actual tourism business or just a person trying to make a few extra bucks, Natalie?
I think, you know, it's really people taking advantage of, you know, of the extreme number of people that are going to be there. But saying that, I mean, I've seen so many hotels that are going to be in the line of the eclipse everywhere, from, you know, the States run San Antonio, where it's going to be, and across Canada. I know Marriott has been offering lots of solar eclipse deals. So, you know, come stay for the solar eclipse package. And, you know, they've been offering, you know, two nights for the price of three, or you know, we're going to offer A, B, and C. So I've seen across the tourism industry, people are absolutely making the most of this and absolutely creating packages around this, offering goggles. So I think, you know, from a marketing tourism agency point of view, it is helpful for those in the line of the eclipse. And, you know, in Niagara Falls, those that are renting out their backyard for campers, you know, they've just kind of hopped onto that trend.
Mayor Diodati, I mean, what about that? Have people thought about that? If you've paid someone privately, I mean, there might definitely be a situation where roads are closed or whatever, and you can't get to where you're supposed to be.
Well, and that'll be a challenge we're going to have to deal with as it happens. And a lot of people participate in the gig economy where you can monetize your house or your car. And I think it's great. It gives everybody a chance to benefit and to participate. And it's nice that people are opening up their homes and it adds more, you know, capacity, because right now we definitely have a big challenge. I also love the clever marketing that Natalie was talking about, where I've seen a lot of restaurants are having eclipse and sips and all different fun things around the sun. I can tell you that we're going to have the Guinness Book of World Records here. We're going to be attempting a world record, the most people in the identical sun costume. So we're going to be out on one of the boats. Yeah, oh yeah.
Are you wearing a sun costume?
Well, I might be. I can tell you, I'm riding my bike down there with my backpack that day to not add to the extra vehicles. And we're going to do it on one of the hornblower boats. They did go into the water this weekend. It's one of the earliest starts in history because of the warm winter. And a lot of people will be watching the eclipse from one of the boats. And it's going to be a real exciting day. So I think the smart marketer is taking advantage of it, capitalizing. And our big message is come early, come prepared, don't be patient. You know, there's going to be a lot of people wanting to see the same thing. And Niagara Falls, it's going to be a magical place because, let's face it, it's Mother Nature doing what she does best, the great natural wonder of the world, Niagara Falls, and one of the great events, celestial events of the universe at the same time, the same place. It won't happen again for 120 years in Niagara Falls. It's an exciting, cool thing to be at, and I hope we can come together, enjoy it, and everybody's a little patient that day.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked earlier, and I do question that million people number because it came from, you explained that it came from this documentary crew that follows eclipses. But, you know, Niagara Falls has a lot of tourists anyway. Do you have a number in mind? Is there a number that's comfortable? I mean, the last biggest thing was, I think, what, 150,000 people for Nick Wallenda?
Yeah, for Nick Wallenda. And then right after that is our New Year's Eve shows. And we've learned a lot from doing big events like that, including extra cell towers and things like this because of the bandwidth challenge and also the cross-border challenge with the signal from the U.S. But yeah, this company, it's called Sandbox Films. Their movie is called Totality. And they've been covering these all over. And they said, especially given the fact we're within a 1 day's drive of half the population of North America, so we've got a very strong rubber tire market that can mobilize very quickly. And the weather has a huge impact on tourism for us because it's rubber tire, because you can change, you know, on a dime. People definitely follow the weather. And as we get closer, I can tell you that'll have a direct impact on the numbers. And what's the actual number going to be? The last total solar eclipse was 99 years ago. So we don't really know, but we're preparing for a million, and we'll be ready if that happens. And if it's less, then we'll be overprepared. And I hope that's the case. We're overprepared.
Well, you know, it's within a day's drive if the roads are not parking lots. So, I mean,
you're right.
You know, there's construction everywhere and so many people. I think that's going to be a big challenge.
Well, and that's why we're really encouraging people to take the GO train. And I can tell you, Metrolinx is adding a bunch of trains like they did for Nick Wallenda. There's no traffic jams on the train tracks. And worst case scenario, if you had to walk from the GO train station to the falls, it's about a 20-minute leisure walk. It's not a big deal. And I'm telling people, if it was me, like when I go into Toronto to watch Blue Jay games, I much prefer taking the GO train. I'm encouraging people, do that first. If you have to drive, come a day earlier, a couple days early. Make it a weekend event. We're going to have a lot of programming, so there'll be educational things. And the last thing I say is, you know, tourism has changed, and I'm sure Natalie would know better than anyone. People want natural experiences, experiential tourism, eat with the locals, eat, drink with the locals, drink. And whereas in the 70s, during the last partial solar eclipse, in school, they closed the curtains. They told us, stay away from the windows. Don't look outside. Now we say, wear your ISO-certified eclipse glasses. Let's go outside. And then at a certain point, we're all going to take them off and look up. And I think, wow, the world has changed significantly when it comes to tourism.
Okay. And Natalie, what's your advice to people who are thinking of braving the traffic and the crowds and everything else?
Well, I think, as the mayor said, you know, we should definitely look at public transit. You are 100% right when you said that what we are looking for as travel consumers, we're looking for experiences that are outside, that are memorable, that, you know, we're collecting memories instead of things. And I think this is going to be a fantastic opportunity to create an amazing memory. So by all means, head down and take public transit, avoid that parking lot or QEW, whatever you'd like to call it, and just really make the most of what Niagara Falls has got going on, because it does sound like it's going to be a fantastic weekend.
Okay, yeah, well, it'll be very interesting for sure. Jim Diodati, I'm going to give the last word to you. What do you want to tell people, and what are you hoping that this will do in terms of a lasting result for Niagara Falls?
Well, I can tell you, Libby, after COVID, we're hit really hard as Canada's number one leisure destination. The international tourism has been the last to come back, and Mother Nature is giving us something we could never afford to do. And it's put us from the back burner onto the front burner around the world. Although Niagara Falls is very well known as one of the great natural wonders of the world, it's not enough to be known. You need to be talked about. And now that we're being talked about, I'm hopeful people around the world are planning their trips to come back to Canada, come back to Niagara Falls, and visit us. So with NASA here, the Canadian Space Agency, and Guinness Book of World Records, and a whole bunch of our friends, we're hoping that it'll be a celebration that people will talk about for a long, long time.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll talk again, certainly after, if not before. Thank you so much, Mayor Jim Diodati and Natalie Preti.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.